welcome back to Living on the Edge. Join your host, Jake Beck, Product Manager at Ambassador Labs. This is your podcast for all things related to Kubernetes, developer tooling, API gateways, service mesh implementation, and more. Let's get into it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Living on the Edge. I'm here with Natan Yellen, the CEO at Robusta. That's about all I'm going to go into for the background. Natan, if you want to take it away and give us a little bit of introduction.
Yeah, sure. So I come from a software engineering background. I was a software developer, mostly did cybersecurity for the past 10 years. And then eventually moved over from like more of the classical network security stuff and no more kernel stuff to cloud security. And I got to know Kubernetes firsthand. And then today at Robusta, so I'm one of the co-founders, and what we do is we have a platform that helps busy DevOps and SRE teams and platform teams offload a lot of the work that they do to support developers, troubleshooting issues in production, looking at their application, from the silly stuff like where are my logs to the complicated stuff like there's a really weird Kubernetes issue, how do I troubleshoot that? So we help those teams, that those developers self-service, and solve those problems on their own with a self-service platform.
That's super interesting. I thought it was funny that you mentioned logs, because honestly, every time I go to look for Kubernetes logs, I'm like, oh God, where do I start?
Yeah, so it's weird because it's either like depending on the organization, the logs are really accessible. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just a huge pain to like copy paste pot. Like the way you query them is not so accessible. Mm-hmm. Or the logs are super accessible, but the devs actually by design don't have access to them because and then you want to give them access to like stuff on their application, but not to other stuff. So it's a wide variety of weird, like enterprise-y stuff for why developers actually need that type of empowerment. Plus the broad thing, which is like, okay, developers just don't often have that Kubernetes expertise. And they just want to say, okay, where's my app? Here's all the stuff for my app. Like, what do I do? Is there an issue? Yes, no. And like get back to development.
Yeah, they want to see the logs almost on like a way that if they were doing like local development where it's just like right there, right? It's like, okay, I know exactly what's wrong, not having to dig through all the Kubernetes stuff to like if you're not in Kubernetes, like using even like kubectl all the time, right? It's like, okay, I have to refresh all these commands and try like 15 different times before I even get close to what I want.
So I'll give it, this is a good transition maybe to the topic of the podcast as well, and I'll give you an analogy here that I think is really like illustrative. We always say you build it, you run it, right?
Yeah.
But I want to give an analogy that will sound insane from not the software industry. So imagine that you have an engineer and he has some background in like metalworking or whatever, like mechanical engineering. And he works at a factory and he builds screws. And there are these really fantastic, like industrial grade screws that used to screw into stuff and they hold it really tight. Now, someone takes those screws and they assemble that into an airplane. And the screw is one of the parts of that airplane. And they put the engineer in the cockpit of that airplane and they say, okay, you build it, you run it. Well, he didn't build the whole airplane. I mean, he built the screw, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's not a pilot. And you sit him down in the airplane and there's all the panels and all the gadgets and the doodads and whatever. And you say, okay, like fly the plane. And then not just that, but you give it to him, like the only when you say it to him, it's not like it's even midair and you hold like the wheel and driver though. No, you give it to him right at the instant when it's crashing. And you say, fly a plane and fix it. I feel that often is what's happening now with cloud native, where you have developers who are really good at building applications and they know Java and they already know C or Go or whatever. They have really good application knowledge, but they don't. They aren't necessarily familiar with the sometimes convoluted stack that runs on in the cloud. Even on Kubernetes, which I love, like you're now not just running your application, you're running your application, which is getting secrets from Vault, right? And there's probably an API gateway there. And there's a service mesh, right? And there are sidecars and it's running inside the container, fine. You get Docker files, that's already easy. And it's running inside a pod. Okay, you kind of get pods and Replica site inside the deployment. And that's connected to a Kubernetes service, which then connects to the service mesh. And that's running on some node, and there could be a node issue. And then you get something like QHPA maxed out or like some alert or something. I'm throwing out terms, but like you get some of that because that's how it feels. Mm-hmm. And then you say, okay, well, like you build it, you run it, like you're in charge of that and go and handle it. And where that often breaks down is then people go and they just like, they say the DevOps engineer, like, okay, like, what do I do? And people want to be empowered. Like people want to own stuff. You want to have ownership. If you're that guy who built the screw and you get to be in there, but then you see what it's doing in action, like that's really cool. And like you, it's exciting to be part of like the technology that went into building an airplane and all the other stuff. It's really interesting to learn, but you don't want to get shoved into that cockpit when the plane is crashing and have to deal with all the stuff that you have no expertise in, and then not have like and have a sink or swim attitude.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like, just right off the bat, I kind of was just like, well, I disagree with you, and then you kept going, and I was like, okay, like. It makes sense, right? Like, especially if you think about like at scale, like the you build it, you run it really doesn't work at scale, like large scale, right? Like maybe if you have a really small application where like it's just a really simple stack, that's fine. But like you said, as you continue to grow and you get into something that is like as good and amazing as Kubernetes is, it's extremely complicated to like fully understand and have like a breadth of knowledge in it is not something you can easily do while also like writing super good code all the time and like running a production, continually writing production level code while also still trying to have like a vast understanding of like this tech stack that's running in some cloud environment. So I think you sold me on that where it's like.
So I'll tell you who does you build it, you run it. If you take a 10 person startup or a 20 person startup, and you have phenomenal engineers and they get the like all the cloud stuff and they build it, and you often don't have that extra layer of complexity. Like, okay, mm-hmm. You can for secrets, but you probably don't have an API gateway or a service mesh. Like, you're not at that level of maturity yet anyway.
Right.
So in these small startups or in smaller companies, 100 people, 200 people, you have like a really core team, and you're only hiring people who are like really up to date, and you don't have a legacy application. You don't have a lot of other stuff that you're carrying with you. It's all a new stack and it's all new. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's born on Kubernetes from day one and everyone knows it. Like, okay, in those places, it kind of works. But if you look at Fortune 500, who's doing you build it, you run it? Like, take Google, right? They don't do you build it, you run it. They have SRE teams. So they have one SRE for every 10 developers, and the SRE is kind of running the operations on it, right? Sure, the developers are involved. I'm not saying we go back to what we did 30 years ago. Like build it, throw it over the wall, give it to IT, IT runs it. I'm not saying you should do that either. But what we're starting to see now, what's interesting is we're starting to see now, it's emerged as a movement, the pushback almost to you build it, you run it. And it's emerged as a movement that people are starting to say, you know what? Here you have, like on one side you have, build something, throw it over to the wall to IT, IT owns it. There's no ownership, no one like, the people who have to do things don't actually like have knowledge to do it, whatever, it doesn't work. Over here, you have on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have you build it, you run it, and it's sink or swim. Like you build it, you run it, you take it. There, like if you look at the original DevOps manifesto and you look at like how people thought about DevOps, anyone who has the job title DevOps is not doing DevOps. DevOps was supposed to be developers doing ops. So if you have a company and like in your company, you have job title DevOps, well, you're not doing DevOps as it was originally envisioned. Of course, you're doing DevOps. I mean, that's what DevOps has become. And you're doing important work. And like, I would argue you're actually filling a really important role. But you're not doing you build it, you run it. Mm-hmm. So what the industry has kind of done is to push back, not really on you build it, you run it, because no one's been doing it anyway. What the industry has done is to push back on saying you build it, you run it is just the whole solution. And now it's under the banner of platform engineering. And people are essentially saying, okay, like you just give it to IT, it doesn't work. You just say a developer sink or swim, it doesn't work. So you build it, you run it, but you get enablement and you have to like, you get support from these platform teams and you're enabled and we care about developer experience. It's not, we'll shove everything in the world onto you.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a ton of sense, especially as like you started to talk about like the Fortune 500, right? It's like so many of those companies have built out internal platforms to mask so much of the background of what's a lot of times just Kubernetes, right? But they built these platforms that you go in and you deploy your Docker image or whatever, and you have access to your logs and like your metrics to your specific container, but you don't see what's going on in the background. And I think you said it like perfect there. It's just like the DevOps roles and everything, right? Like aren't what they originally envisioned. And I think that's like a perfect example. And it's like basically been folded into the like platform engineering as that's continued to emerge as like its own thing in the industry.
So it's,
I had a question for you then, like how are you doing it differently than like within Robusta? Like I'm very curious what you guys are doing differently in that aspect.
So what we do is we give like companies and ranging from startups to very large enterprises running Kubernetes on-premise or like US government. We give companies like that who today are supporting these, like have a DevOps team that is constantly like fielding support queries essentially from developers. We give them like a single pane of glass that they roll out to their developers, and then the developer goes in, he just sees his application and he sees the logs, he sees the memory, he sees everything he needs to see. He can take certain actions and he sees the information that's relevant for him. And it's oriented around the way a developer thinks. Meaning if you look at the way ops thinks, then like you have almost different subsystems, right? Like let's say you have a pod that's auto-scaled by the HPA and it's running on a node somewhere and then there are logs, like all those things would be like different dashboards almost because they're like different subsystems. It's a different Grafana template, like template dashboard, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the way like the developer thinks, it's not thinking about that. Like it's just my application. I want to see everything related to my application on one page. So what we do is we give a platform on top of your existing observability data, and we're built with the tightest integration here on top of like Prometheus, Thanos, Victoria Metrics, anything that's Prometheus-like. And we give a platform on top of that where you can go in and each developer just sees a page with the stuff that matters for him and firing alerts and issues and things that need his attention and other cost problems like inefficiencies that he should deal with, but all made simple in a way that a developer who doesn't have all that expertise can really understand. So conceptually, a little almost like an internal developer platform, but really oriented around like starting with what goes on a day-to-day basis in production that platform engineers and DevOps teams are like fielding support on. And that's oriented around like day negative one, how am I going to scaffold out a new application?
Okay, that's really interesting. So it's definitely like more geared towards like not the really the platform engineer specifically. It's more geared towards the people writing the whatever that cloud app is or whatever. So if they can see it in a way that makes sense without having to really know Kubernetes, I would assume. It's more of like
exactly
abstracting not confusion, but the complexity that Kubernetes really is.
But with two distinctions. One, you don't have to like redeploy your software via our platform. So we're not like some of the stuff out there that's around this will say, okay, like we're giving you a platform. Now you deploy everything our way. Like we don't do that. So we just look at what's already out there and then we give you a portal on top of that with zero configuration. Like, because if you think about it, all the metadata is actually already out there, like all the services are already running. Like you shouldn't have to now change all your YAML files and deploy something with some weird CRD I give you. Like you would never do that, first of all. And like, why should you? Like all the stuff is already out there. It's being deployed, maybe deploying it via Helm charts, whatever. But like being able to look at what's already there and then say, okay, like this is one app, this is another app, this is another app. Here, show that person and stuff for him that he cares about. And then the second distinction is we are brought in for developers, but we're almost always brought in by platform teams.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of like the value that we're bringing them and the way that like this is often justified in organizations that we can dramatically reduce the number of like tickets that they're getting from developers. So we see like reductions of like 50% in the support tickets that they then have to go and field.
No, I think that's really interesting. Like it's brought in essentially by the platform engineers to make their jobs easier by making the developers' jobs easier. Kind of, right? Like a little bit.
It's interesting because it's like there's two major stakeholders and you're kind of building for both of them. You're building for the developers, but you're also building for the platform teams because they're the one who's giving budget and they're the one who actually is benefiting most day to day because now they free up all this time.
Yeah, for sure. I guess like kind of on that topic of like monitoring all that, like I guess what are like your platform's built around like essentially monitoring everything. Like what do you think are some of the like best practices that you help implement that a lot of people might not be doing or are doing incorrectly right now?
So the first one I would say is be application centric. And no matter how you do it, no matter whatever the technology, you want to give application developers something that's oriented around what they think of and what they care about. So they should not have to like go to one dashboard to see like certain aspects that relate to their application, like running in the cloud, and then to go another dashboard to see a different one. And like a good example of this is like you typically go like one dashboard to see stuff on the HPA, right? And how it's being auto scale. But then there's a different dashboard for your like pods. And then there's different, like all those things are part of one holistic picture. Like this is my app, here's its YAML, here's when it was last changed and rolled out. Here is like what's going on right now. Here are the alerts that I've fired on this. But it giving that single pane of glass for what an application developer actually cares about, because the application developer does not know each of the front end dashboards that's out there and where he has to go and where he has to look. Like the data is all there. It just isn't organized in a way that promotes like a troubleshooting workflow for developers. Mm-hmm. So that's the first tip. And then the second tip is try and drive people to action. Like everything you're showing should drive to action. An action can be like an action that you're taking, that you're going back and you're changing something in Git, or you're taking, like there's something that's stuck in some issue, some transient issue, and you like delete the pod and it fixes it. Maybe that's common on Kubernetes. But like you can have actions like that, and you can have actions like I wrong sized my resource, I over allocated it by 200%, I should downsize it. So think about how you build something that drives people to action and doesn't just throw up like a wall of information that then, again, people don't always know what to do with. So they, like when people are confused, they do nothing. So drive people to action.
I love that.
And I could go on, but I think those are the two main ones.
Well, I love the action one because we've all just had annoying alerts or whatever that we're like, oh, that one flaps all the time. We don't need to do anything about it. And it's like, that's such bad practice that is so common, because it's like, well, if the alert's just flapping or something and you ignore it, you should fix the alert. Or maybe it does need an action and you should take that action, right? So it's like, even like, I think even like a flappy alert like that is an action item, right? Like you should do something about it. And so many of us are just like, we have better things to do or whatever it is. And we'll just learn to ignore it. And then when something bad actually happens, you're just so used to ignoring it. So I love that you say about the action thing.
Let me say something controversial. Okay?
I love controversial takes, so let's hear it.
I love GitOps. Mm-hmm. I think the philosophy behind GitOps is fantastic. I think it's great that you have an audit log of everything that can happen. That happens. Like I think it's great that you can roll back. I think it's great you can manage changes with a pull request on GitHub. GitOps is phenomenal. It is a terrible fit though for handling like some aspects of alerting and thresholds, because it does not drive you to action. If you have an alert and you get that alert in Slack and you say, it's that same darn alert that I inspired every single day for the past, like, since I've been at the company, it's been firing and no one has ever gone in silence. And I don't even know which Git value to go with to go modify to change that. That does not drive to action. And that is how everyone is deploying their Prometheus alerts. And it's a terrible way of doing it. Like if you want to manage templates for those alerts in Git, fantastic. But really when it comes to thresholds and it comes to silencing, it comes to stuff like that, that is not something that makes sense to handle in Git. I know that's a controversial take and I know many people would disagree with me on that. And product-wise, like we do help now with managing, we're throughout something with managing Prometheus alerts for those applications. And we are taking from day one a non-GitOps approach. And then we'll be adding on like a GitOps compatible approach on day two. Because there are people who demand it. No one's going to change how they work because of what I said. But we see a lot of the trouble that causes when people have alerts and it's causing a ton of noise. And people do not go and silence it. And it's even worse when you look again at like how companies are working. You build it. You run it like this. How companies actually work. You have a DevOps engineer or a platform engineer who defines some alert on the infrastructure, or if it's like a default alert from Kube Prometheus stack, and that's running and that's firing, and the developer whose application is firing on often has no clue what you would even do to make that alert not come. And it's the way that like the way the responsibilities are set up, the way you even have permissions to go and like which repository you'd have to go and edit, like the entire pattern is built towards the eventual outcome that the developers ignore all the Prometheus alerts they get. And that doesn't work really well.
Right. So what do you recommend for like maintaining those then? Because like the benefit of the GitOps, right, is like anyone can go in and like you can see it. It's saved in whatever GitHub, GitLab, whatever you use. Like what's your approach then instead of GitOps for that?
So where we want to be, and we're getting there, we're almost there, but where we want to be and what we want to be able to offer is you manage the templates to that in Git, but the thresholds and the overrides for specific applications, you have the option of managing in Git, but you also have the option of just clicking a button and having it disabled. And then in an ideal world, you click a button to disable that and it like disables it for 24 hours, but like also opens a PR on the Git repo to go and do that. And there's a really interesting write back question. Like in the whole Kubernetes world and with everything GitOps related, there's a really interesting write back question. You see a problem occurring in some Kubernetes infrastructure, and then going backwards and figuring out what do you change in GitOps is non-trivial. In fact, it used to be somewhat intractable. And what I mean by that is I'll give you a trivial example. You have a deployment that spawn. You have a Helm chart, and in that Helm chart is some value for like a memory request, right? And that's how much memory the pod needs. And if you get that number wrong, the pod crashes. So it's an important number. So you have in that Git repository a number for a memory request, and that's one of the Helm values. And then Helm has a bunch of templates, and it runs all those templates. And then somewhere in there's an outputted deployment file, and then that runs on Kubernetes and creates a replica set, and that creates a pod. And then the pod runs, and the pod is eventually killed because that initial number in Helm was wrong. Now, you can go back from that pod, and you can find the deployment really easily. And then you know that deployment was created by Helm. But it's actually probably like a non-computable problem to take that thing that was templated out and then to go back and find the value that templated. I mean, it's not exactly non-computable. It's potentially non-computable in the generic case because like reversing that templatization step is very hard. You can do it.
I've done it. I just have flashbacks of me having to do this when you're walking through it. I'm like, okay, oh no.
Did you do it with code? Doing it as a human is easy. Did you do it with code though? Like to have code that can generically reverse it is, I should be careful here saying it's not incomputable. Like there actually are some approaches that we can touch on that. It's probably super technical, maybe a little too technical for the topic here, but doing it as a human, we do it all the time. Everyone does it all the time. But having software that's opening a PR and then going back and figuring out which line, that is like, I haven't proven it, but I haven't taken the time to prove it, but it's potentially non-computable. Like if you get into like the Turing problem and like, or sorry, the halting problem, like it's potentially something that's non-computable from a theoretical perspective. And there are approaches, if you like add a Helm plugin, you add on annotations, there are probably approaches that can tackle it. But the cool thing is that you can actually solve that trivially now with AI. Like just feed in the values, feed in a few templates and like say which one of these is responsible. And actually then that is like a really trivial solution.
That's super interesting. Like the AI approach. Yeah. Like I guess like you guys are taking advantage of something similar with that with AI, right?
Yeah. We rolled out a feature that uses AI to do what a DevOps engineer would do, or a good SRE would do, or like a great engineer who knows Kubernetes would do, or a great developer who knows Kubernetes would do. And the way it works is this: you open up your application on Kubernetes. So like imagine opening up Lens, but it's in the browser and any developer who has permissions can access it. And so a developer opens it up and he sees his application. And there's some error in his application. Could be that the application is like impending. It could be that his application is healthy, but it has a firing Prometheus alert. It could be a bunch of stuff, right? His application has some issue. And Robusto like shows you, okay, it's red, so like that's bad, right? And then it gives you all the information on that page. And then there's some stuff we did also pre-AI to like automatically gather the right data and surface it to you and show it to you. But then the cool thing is we added on recently, I got some really good feedback on this, an AI investigation button. And you just hit that button and it gathers up a whole bunch of data. So it gathers up like the YAMLs for that pod or related resources. It gathers up the Kubernetes events, so like kubectl get events, right? And then filters out on the stuff that's relevant. It gathers up the logs, right? It gathers up like if the reliability probe's failing, it sees that. That's actually in the events, I think. It gathers up all this different data, and then it feeds it into an AI model, and we built it to be like pluggable, or you can bring a private tenant, or by default, we just use Azure with our own instance. And then it goes and it spits out for you what is the problem, plus what is the data, like pulling out all that data, what is the data that was relied on to reach that conclusion, so you can see that like it's not hallucinating. And then what do we recommend doing to fix that? And then the
final step, that's perfect,
is then that right back to Git, which we don't have yet. I think with AI, it actually is doable now.
Yeah, no, that's super cool. Just like using, just to speed up that investigation process, even if it requires some intervention from a human, right? Like even just gathering all that data is super valuable in like one specific area, even like if, because like it's not always going to be, it's AI, right? There's never 100% accuracy with AI, but having it, the like you said, the like, here's the data that we made this decision from, and like you can go and validate it then, like that's huge for so many people to just speed up that loop of debugging those issues. Like,
so there's a UK colleague of mine at another company, consultancy, and they took this and they were playing around with it, and they got it hooked up also to like, I think to Jaeger Traces, and they did a bunch of stuff. And then what they were able to do in one of the demos that they gave at a conference recently is they showed how they break, like you have microservice A that's speaking to microservice B, and you break B, and then A starts malfunctioning, but nothing changed on A. And then with the AI, one of the things that we feed in is like a list of all recent changes in the cluster. And then with AI, it was able to spit out and say, this broke because of this change in a completely different microservice, which if you're the developer, you're looking at microservice, hey, you have, like, you often don't even know that B changed. So that's like another cool example of this, where the data, like, I don't want to say it doesn't matter if it hallucinates, but we're not asking questions that are as hallucination prone, meaning we're not asking. One of the interesting things, actually, is we found that if you say, is there a problem? We actually got really bad results. We had a very high hallucination rate. There was always a problem. Whatever it was, like you're feeling in the logs, there will always be an error. And AI actually had a really like hard time with current models, state-of-the-art models. We had a really hard time like understanding what is a problem that a human would interpret as a problem and what is a problem that a human would glance and say, like, that's not interesting. If there is a problem, like an alert firing or some unhealthy pod status, then saying like, where is the other data I should be looking at and feeding in a bunch of data and having it pick out the right pieces, that's not very hallucination prone.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? Yeah, like, I mean, you could say that with anything, right? It's like, is there a problem? It's always going to say yes. Like, there's always probably some problem, but is it a real problem? Maybe not. And that's where like what you're saying is like feeding it the right data to actually like discover like, not a, I guess like a fail point instead of like a problem, right? Because like a problem can be super vague. Like, I think it's super smart. And like you said, it works now versus like if you just asked if there was a problem, it was just, if there wasn't one, it's still just going to say yes. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And then the industry term is like RAG or retrieval augmented generation. And what really makes a difference is not, you're not saying, you're not like saying, here's a problem, what is it? You're saying, here's a problem, here is a ton of context, like as much as we can pack into the context length, into the like the length of a prompt. Here's a ton of context, and then pick out the relevant stuff. And by giving all the extra context, it's now not relying on stuff that it knows from training time. It's relying on stuff that it knows because you just fed it in right now in the prompt, and you get much, much like more accurate results relevant to what's actually going on in your environment.
Right. That's super interesting. I think the future with AI especially is pretty bright in a lot of areas, especially with something like that. There's definitely areas where it's not so bright, I think, and that's a whole different conversation, but it seems like you're really taking advantage of it and using it the way it's really meant to be. So congrats to you guys for getting on board early, it seems like.
Thank you. It's weird because it like happened all backwards. When I was a kid, they said that AI would like eventually replace programmers. And that AI would like eventually, we're like, okay, well, maybe there is good programming stuff now, but they essentially said like AI would be really good at logic. And like, that's how we all thought of it, right? Like you're gonna have these robots that are like super logical, right? You can think of the caricature of a robot, like it's super logical and it doesn't understand any common sense. And of course it's terrible at creativity.
Yep.
And somehow it all happened the opposite way around. We got stuff that's really creative, but not at all logical, and we'll lie without realizing it. It's like we got all the imprecise stuff and all the R's before we got actually like the hard science and the facts, which I think is just to say that AI is more like humans than we tend to admit.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's almost like scary. It makes similar mistakes that humans do, and it learns in a much different way, obviously, than humans do, but it often ends up in the same results. So it's kind of funny to think about it that way. Well, I think we are winding down on time. So if you want to let people know where they can find you,
So I'm on LinkedIn, Natan Yellen, and on Twitter, AANTN, like my first name, but I must have been a little bit dyslexic in high school. Please feel free to reach out. I always love to hear from people. A lot of times you record a podcast and it goes out, and then like either you get stuff from people or like no one writes anything ever, and you don't even know if people actually listen to it. So it's always really nice to hear from people. And if people have questions or like are interested in any of the stuff we spoke about today, or have opinions, or are doing stuff like that internally, I always like to chat about their approaches and kind of hear like what approaches other companies are taking to stuff, from AI troubleshooting to the stuff around the write back to Git, and also how other people think about encouraging others to take actions.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate your time and great chatting with you.